I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In remote rural New Brunswick, Camp B was established by the Canadian government in 1940 to intern so-called enemy sympathizers. A new book looks at this camp and illuminates a dark period in Canadian history. It's called Dangerous Enemy Sympathizers, Canadian Internment Camp B, 1940 to 1945. Its author is Andrew Theobald, who joins me now, and I'll ask him about where Camp B was, who was interned, what they did there up to the end of the Second World War, as well as the contemporary discussion as to the ethics of internment. Andrew Theobald holds history degrees from Mount Allison University, the University of New Brunswick, and Queen's University. He has worked as a researcher on an oral history project involving veterans from the Second World War, as well as historical documentaries. His previous books include The Bitter Harvest of War, New Brunswick, and The Conscription Crisis of 1917. This new book is published by Goose Lane. It is volume 26 in the New Brunswick Military Heritage Series. Please welcome to the Plant on Line program in Toronto, Andrew Theobald. Dr. Theobald, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us. Where is Ripples?
Ripples is a very small community in central New Brunswick. It's about 35 kilometers to the east of Fredericton, the capital of the province, and very near to Minto, which is a little town that used to be the center of the coal mining community in the coal mining industry in New Brunswick.
And so to paint a picture of where it is, I mean, you already told us where it is, but what does it look like there? I mean, is it a forest? Is it remote?
It's extremely remote, even by the standards of central New Brunswick, where not a lot of people live to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It had a population of approximately 100 in 1940 when the internment camp was established very near to the village. And it's not only that it's remote, it's that it's heavily forested, and what ground there is tends to be extremely boggy. There's very poor drainage in the area, so it's really not a pleasant place to be, and that's especially true in the winter months.
So I suppose that's one of the reasons why they picked this place, right?
Absolutely, certainly.
Yeah. How were dangerous enemy sympathizers, how were they determined?
Well, this is quite a long process, and it's one that your listeners may find a little difficult to believe, simply because the first group of dangerous enemy sympathizers, and the reason for the title of the book as well, were German and Austrian citizens that had come to Great Britain as refugees from Central Europe, and the vast majority of these individuals were Jews. But they became dangerous enemy sympathizers, labeled as such by the British government, in May of 1940, when the German invasion of France was going so spectacularly well. The British determined that they were in a panic, essentially, and they said any of these individuals, the only reason that France, the foremost military power in Europe, could be in such trouble is if the Germans had already managed to infiltrate the French state, the French military, with sympathizers.
Mm-hmm.
So they figured that amongst these refugees, who were German and Austrian citizens in Britain, there must be some of these Nazi agents. And because it seemed like the invasion of Great Britain was imminent, they decided that these people needed to be put in internment camps first in Great Britain and then sent as far afield as they could comfortably be sent. And that was when they were dispatched to Canada.
And this place in New Brunswick, this wasn't the only place that people from Europe were brought, right?
Not at all. There were I hate to use the phrase heights, but at the largest extent of the Canadian internment operations in the Second World War, there were 40 camps throughout the country, although the vast majority of those were in Ontario and Quebec. There were a couple of major ones in Alberta, and Ripples was the only one in the Maritime provinces.
I see. And then, of course, I'm speaking to you from Vancouver,
yes,
where the Japanese were interned here in British Columbia, as well as in parts of the prairies, as well, if I recall.
Absolutely correct, yes.
Yeah. I guess there were no Japanese east of Ontario, were there?
That's correct. There was actually one individual who was a Japanese citizen who spent a brief period of time in Ripples, but he was not. He was an actual Japanese citizen who was there. Apparently was an issue about whether or not he could obtain diplomatic immunity.
Uh-huh.
So he did spend a period of time in the internment camp, but he was completely unlike the operation in Ripples. Has nothing whatsoever to do with everybody calls it the internment of the Canadian-Japanese population, but it's really much else besides. It's a mass population displacement that the government ordered, in which it, of course, involved elderly people, children, women, whereas in the case of Ripples and most of the other internment operations, all the individuals in the camps were men between the ages of 16 and 60.
How was this justified at the time?
The justification certainly for sending these original dangerous enemy sympathizers, the predominantly Jewish refugees that I mentioned earlier, to Ripples, was because it was felt like even if these individuals were not in any way sympathetic, which of course they were not, with Nazi Germany, it was felt that if their families could be held hostage by the German authorities, they might send something in a letter to Germany that involved sensitive information, and the risk was felt by the British at the time in the panic that there was just no other option. These people had to be sent far away.
Yeah. The feeling, though, I mean, that's obviously a government policy. What was the feeling amongst the people? I mean, I guess you mentioned the word panic earlier.
Yeah.
I guess the people got swept up in that, didn't they?
They certainly did. And this was very true of the British media, and as far as you can tell, usually from British media sources in May of 1940, by the general public as well. The feeling was they didn't want anybody who was German, and there wasn't a lot of distinction shown, obviously, from the central story about the fact these people were Jewish, mm-hmm. and for the most part, and that they had actually fled Germany in many cases because they'd already been incarcerated in concentration camps or because they feared for their lives. But the British public didn't care at the time. What really helped to change this was that of the four ships that sent the first batch of dangerous enemy sympathizers to Canada, which included the predominantly Jewish refugees who were incarcerated at Ripples, but also other individuals, including genuine German prisoners of war. But one of those vessels was torpedoed and sank by a U-boat while crossing the Atlantic. And a number of the people who died, over 800 people died in the sinking of that vessel. It was called the Arendora Star. And the British public, when they realized that many of the people in that vessel were Italians, mm-hmm. but who had been living in Britain for a long time. So they were also interned by the British government when Italy entered the war.
Right.
And the British public was flabbergasted that these individuals, in many cases, they were well above fighting age, men in their 50s and 60s, for instance, some of whom had children in the British Army. And here they were being drowned in this horrible circumstance. And that one action did a huge amount to change the British public's attitude and say, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. And gradually you had the Jewish refugees who'd been interned in Britain were released from the camps in the British Isles. And many of them went on to play very prominent roles in the war. Mm-hmm. They're certainly far overrepresented in the British Intelligence Corps because so many of them were fluent in German. Mm-hmm. A number of them going to be, for instance, active translators at the Nuremberg trials, obviously. Mm-hmm. Much later on after the war. But the really interesting thing, and this is something I devote a lot of attention to in the story, is that the Jewish internees at Ripples were not released after it became clear that they posed no danger, and in fact most of them made clear they want to assist the Allied war effort in any way they can.
Yeah.
But the Canadian government of the time was completely opposed to Jewish immigration. So what they tried to do was return these individuals to Britain. Some of them did volunteer to do so. Or they try to get the United States to say, would you take these people? And the United States said, we don't really know much about them. They've come to Canada through what they call non-established channels. They're not regular immigrants. So we're not interested in them either. So they had this long period there, incarcerated for the better part of a year in New Brunswick, even though it's very clear that they're not dangerous enemy sympathizers at all.
This reticence on Canada's part, we've read about some of that with regards to how Mackenzie King felt.
Yes.
And I guess there was a strain of anti-Semitism, but did Canadians not know, say, about concentration camps at that point?
I don't think they really did, or it's funny, they could, of course, have heard it from the internees themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really striking is that the guards, the local people, because of course there were local tradespeople who did work on the camp, including construction of the entire area in the first place. When they interacted with these individuals, most of whom could speak English, some of them had been in Britain for quite some time, as long as 1933, And they made clear that they how they really felt about Nazi Germany. And so it actually trickled out from the camp that these people are, you know, regardless of what the British government is saying or what the Canadian government is not sharing with the wider public, these people are fighting the same on the same side here. So it's really interesting, and another thing I spent a lot of time discussing in the book is just how it became, the Ripples internment camp itself became something of a laboratory where some of the ideas that the Canadian public had been hearing, not just from the government, but there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the air in the period, was debunked by actual interaction with Jewish people.
So in this period of 1940 to 1945, how many people were incarcerated there at Camp B?
Yes, the number varied. During the period where the Jewish refugees were there, it never reached higher than 711. But what's really interesting about the story as well is that when those individuals were released in 1941, they were replaced almost immediately after just a short two-week period by many people who were genuine dangerous enemy sympathizers. So non-combatants, but there were German merchant mariners, for instance, who'd been captured if their ships were in a Canadian port or by the Royal Canadian Navy at sea. There were individuals who had made clear that they supported the Germans in the 1930s, some of whom were under surveillance by the RCMP. And these individuals in their hundreds were also incarcerated in Ripples. And they were later joined by Italian Canadians. There were a number of Italian Canadians who ended up at Ripples. And also by, I hate to use the phrase again, but it's in the book as well, there's homegrown Canadian fascists, so people who sympathized with the Axis powers,
right.
But were not themselves Italian or German citizens, for instance. And there was the most infamous of these gentlemen was named Adrien Arcon, a fascist from Montreal. He was in Ripples along with many of his cronies in what was at one point called the National Unity Party, so a fairly large, although it made more noise than actual number of supporters, fascist party that developed in Canada.
Right.
And also, probably the most famous internee, certainly the best known that ended up at Camp B in Ripples, was Camille Oude, who had been the mayor of Montreal for a large period of time and was the mayor of Montreal when he was arrested and then interned, and became the mayor of Montreal again after his release. But he spoke out publicly against national mobilization, against any form of compulsory military service, and the Canadian government felt he's too influential a politician to speak out against something like that. So they went as far as to have him interned, and he spent until August of 1944 in the Ripples internment camp.
What was this history that you write about in your book, Dangerous Enemy Sympathizers, was this heretofore unknown?
Not completely unknown, but certainly it's an every historian, I think, when they write a book, says this, that it's a little-known story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's been quite a lot of, locally in that part of New Brunswick, there's quite a few stories. There are so many people whose families were connected to the camp, largely because they worked there as tradespeople or as guards at the camp. So there's always been a lot of local rumor surrounding it. There was a two-volume series of books about the camp that came out in the 1980s, from New Ireland Press, which is a publisher in Fredericton. But I don't think it got a lot of attention outside of the province. And so this was certainly something that I wanted to, a story that I wanted to tell, and I wanted to do my part as much as I could to ensure that it's a little better known.
What's fascinating as I'm reading your book is I get a great sense of what Ripples was like day to day.
Yes.
And what people did there while they were there.
Yes, and I thought that I really tried to tell the story through some personal characters, so the reader, I hope, can empathize. Naturally, I, of course, have not had the experience of being in an internment camp, but I tried to make sure that the characters were people that readers could relate to regardless. And so they would find out that, all right, how did these people pass the time? There were mental health crises, but there were also things like escape attempts. And the more mundane, what did they eat? What did they do for entertainment? What did they do for sex? These things are all very important, and of course I wanted to make sure that the reader got a real sense of that from the book.
And so did you come away with, sympathy is not the right word, but a feeling of what it was like for them in there?
I think so. I'd like to think so anyway. And certainly I felt like, coming into it, I believed that this was a disastrous thing. The internment was a horrible overreaction by the British government, by the Canadian government, by everyone involved. But what I was really impressed with was how the individuals themselves dealt with it. And that's true not only of the gentlemen who were interned, but also of the guards. And I was really struck by, again, the human interaction seemed to change everybody's mind. It didn't matter that the government had said, okay, these people are our enemies. And it was true even in what I call the second stage of the camp, when the individuals were, again, many of them, real enemy sympathizers. They were still treated humanely, and they still, I think, came away from the experience, even though there was no process of rehabilitation or re-education that was built into the camp. I think a lot of the people who went through the experience, nonetheless, that's what happened. They realized, okay, this is ridiculous. Some of the things that, you know, I thought I believed are obviously completely mistaken. And it's quite interesting to see how that played out, yes, unfortunately, in an internment camp, but also through quite humane treatment by the guards and just the people who live near the camp, who had never actually requested that this place be set up or anything. This was just plonked in their midst, and I think they handled the situation remarkably well.
Yeah, I was curious, as I was starting your book, what the war was like in not only in New Brunswick, but in the Maritimes itself. And you write in the book that the Ripples internment camp, established during humanity's worst moments, demonstrated New Brunswick and its people at their best. Have you got a favorite story that illustrates that, something that I guess was redemptive as you were looking at these years of Camp B?
Yes, I mean, it's a bit strange to take that away from it, because it would have been better, certainly, if the place had never existed and nobody had ever felt it was necessary. But one story that really stuck with me, and I use it in the book, there was one gentleman who was a guard at the camp, and in fact, it was very common for people to join what was called the Veterans Guard. So there were some other guards at the camp, but for the most part, history of Camp B, the guards were from what's called the Veterans Guard of Canada. So these were individuals who had already served in the First World War, and they were too old for active service in the Second. But it was a very appealing prospect to be in the Veterans Guard, because it's great pay and close to home. And the New Brunswickers were overrepresented, especially those from the Ripples area, in the Veterans Guard. And there was one individual who actually accompanied the Jewish refugees when they came. They didn't come directly to New Brunswick from Britain. They spent a period of time in Quebec, including at an internment camp in Trois-Rivières. And this gentleman had been a guard as the train came down to New Brunswick to bring the internees to Ripples. And there's a quote from him saying, "I didn't know who these people were. You know, we were told that they were German soldiers, and we had our loaded rifles with bayonets, and we watched them as carefully as we could. And it quickly became clear that they weren't the enemy at all." And a gentleman whose name was Corporal Clarence Wade, he's talking to them, and he realizes, okay, these are mostly young Jewish students, and the one thing they agree on is they do not want to go back to Germany. So they're clearly not dangerous. Now, that gentleman had a son who was enlisted in the Royal Canadian Air Force and actually was killed in action very late in the war, in 1945. And it really hit home for me that, okay, yes, it's one thing to say they're all on the same side, but what really connected these people, in spite of the fact that some of them are armed guards and some of them are prisoners, was that they were actually fighting on the same side in the war. And there's that was not even a unique situation. That happened quite a bit in the camp.
Was the New Brunswick contribution to the war effort in terms of troops sent overseas, was that larger than, say, other parts of the country? Certainly Quebec, obviously.
I think it compared quite favorably, but I'm actually not certain of any specific figure. Certainly my impression, I happen to come from a military family from New Brunswick, is that the answer to the question is yes. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really certain. Definitely the individuals that were connected to this camp. I mean, it's quite remarkable how many people enlisted in the Army, whether it be the Veterans Guard or in active units that did go overseas, in the area around the internment camp was extremely high. I'm certain of that.
And so at the end of the war in 1945, what happened to the actual place itself?
Well, it's amazing how quickly the government felt, because, of course, this was always a federal government installation run by the Department of National Defense, and mm-hmm. with assistance from the Department of Justice. But as soon as the war was over, essentially, the camp was basically destroyed. Now, first, they had a very small number of internees who were still remaining in the camp in August of 1945, once the war, not just with Germany, which ended in May 1945, but the war with Japan was also over. So there were, I believe, a group of 24 internees was all that was left behind the barbed wire in August of 1945. Those individuals were shipped to a camp in Ontario, and then the government very quickly sold the buildings that had been erected on the grounds by public tender. Some of them ended up, appropriately enough, on the campus of the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, mm-hmm. where they were used to house veteran students who were returning from service overseas in the Second World War. And others were purchased locally, and there's even a few that are still around. So you can see what the camp buildings look like. Now, there's nothing too remarkable about them. They were, because the camp was a Department of National Defense structure, they were, the huts and everything were built in exactly the same style as they would have been built in a Canadian Army barracks. So no Canadian soldier, for instance, would be surprised by what the place looked like at the Second World War period. But the barbed wire and everything was obviously made the place a little different. And the government, also the Army, went and destroyed most of the things that were inside the building. So the dishes were smashed, the books were destroyed. Although a very nice part of the story is that in the 1980s, people became, in the local area, quite interested in this, and there were quite a few archaeological work was done on the site, and a number of artifacts have been recovered. There's the New Brunswick Internment Camp Museum, which is in Minto, the nearest community of size to the site of the internment camp. So there's a lovely little museum there where you can see artifacts from the camp. And the internment camp museum has also set up a historical walking trail right off of Route 10, the main road between Fredericton and Minto, where you can see just how remote, first of all, the location is, and how boggy and unpleasant. Mosquitoes and black flies in the summer, and more snow than you ever want to think about in the winter.
You mentioned the previous books that have been written about this place. As you're writing this book, I mean, it's obviously history that we all need to remember, regardless of where we are in this country. As a historian, are there parallels that you can draw to today, perhaps?
Oh, very, very much so. In fact, I only wish the book was not so topical. Certainly, you can see this, and I don't draw a lot of these parallels very strongly in the book. I didn't feel that was its main purpose. Mm-hmm. I think the reader can recognize them. But when you have, for instance, recent decision of the American government to place a travel ban on individuals from certain countries, it's really not that different from the same sort of mindset that was involved in creating the internment camp system in Canada in the Second World War. And the vilification of individuals who belong to certain ethnic groups, for instance, shamefully, that's still with us. Anti-Semitism is still with us. Mm-hmm. There are a number of topical things, and again, I think if readers are encouraged to pick up the book, they'll recognize those without I think my prose hitting them over the head with it.
That's what makes your job, I think, as a historian, all the more important, as we contend with current events, because a lot of us are interested in current events nowadays. I mean, you just have to be.
Certainly, yeah.
But there's a lot of context that we miss, and books like yours, I think, fills that in and helps us think about what choices we need to make.
Absolutely, and I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because that was a central motivation behind the book, and it influences every line that's in there. But again, without perhaps me saying so as clearly as I did a moment ago.
Yeah. Could you talk about the process of writing a book like this? And was there a lot of material that you had handy in terms of giving you the flavor of the times, especially as you do so well in this book?
Yes. It wasn't as straightforward as I think most of the time people would like it to be. And that's, again, partly because of the decision I made to try to build a book around sort of prominent characters. So naturally, in wanting to do that, I needed to make sure I had enough information about those individuals. For instance, there's one individual who is a Jewish refugee who's sent to Camp Ian Ripples. His name is Henry Kreisel. He may be familiar to some listeners. He became a novelist after the Second World War and was a professor of English at the University of Alberta in Edmonton for quite some time. And this was an individual who, thankfully for me as an historian, had written a fair bit about his experiences, including a contemporary diary, which was especially useful because that told me, okay, this is what he thought of the camp on that particular day, and he's not gone back and edited it. You know, he hasn't written it later on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there weren't so many sources like that. So naturally, when I could find one of those, that meant that those characters tended to get a lot more play. It was also striking that there aren't a lot of records of the camp. There are, of course, because the Department of National Defense is running it, there's quite a lot of details of how many individuals are in the camp, how much food is on hand, how many pots there are, that sort of thing. Excuse me. But not a great deal necessarily about what the people in the camp really thought of it. And the media, which is normally a great source, you look at the newspapers of the time, tended to be very quiet about the camp unless there was something where the government actually felt they needed the media's assistance with. So when there were escapes from the camp, none of which were terribly successful, because as I stress in the book, the place the camp was in such a remote location, that's another major reason why it was set up. It's difficult to escape from nowhere, basically. But when that did occur, when people did get over the fence or escape on work parties, then the media tended to pay quite a lot of attention to this because they wanted people to help. And of course, they thought that it was much more advantageous to let people know that there had been an escape rather than try to keep it a secret. Yeah. But the rest of the time, the media said very little about the camp. So it was difficult, but I think I've done a good job of explaining, as you stressed, and I appreciated hearing so, that I've done a decent job of explaining what the day-to-day life of the camp was like.
Yes, you did. Just something you said a moment ago just made me think of because you're a historian, and so you obviously value what's written. I understand you've also done some work with oral histories.
Yes.
How do you document your own life, say?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think that's obviously the big change since long after 1945 is how electronic everything is, how digital everything is these days. And so, yes, I naturally do, and this, I think it's especially true of a camp of this sort. I did value the written record above everything else, but yes, there are quite a few interviews that I used. So there were oral histories, and there's been specific oral historians who've done work on people who were in the camp. That's especially true of Italian Canadians who were in the camp. But yeah, these days it's an entirely different thing, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the coming decades when people start doing historical work of this type about, for instance, an event that's occurring in the present, and where the records themselves will be very different than those that exist for the Ripples internment camp, for instance.
Not many of us keep diaries anymore, so I mean,
Certainly not. Yeah. And I mean, it's worth mentioning that even some of the people who did in the periods between 1940 and 1945 may have been a little bit different. May have, you know, it's not everyone is interested in this practice now. I think diary keeping in that period was something that people did because they realized they were caught up in something immense.
Mm.
And that's a feeling that comes from all the people, of course, from the, you know, guards who were in some cases barely literate, still thought it was important to record their experiences because they knew they were involved in something big. This was a big deal. Here's all these people from Europe, you know, are here in this little community in rural New Brunswick, and it's important for me to record what I think about this.
Yeah, I wonder if historians like yourself, years from now, decades from now, will look at our social media posts as, I guess, the closest thing to a record that one has, I guess, right?
Certainly, and it'll be interesting to see how those things are preserved, because
right.
I think you're quite right. It's a really good point, because many people may not keep diaries any longer, but it's astounding how much information individuals are willing to put out, or lethally put out about the... in using social media. So yeah, I don't know how those sorts of things will be preserved, but I'm sure it will be a major source for future historians.
Your book, Andrew, is a terribly engaging one. I mean, I tried not to pick out people that I liked as I was reading the book or was interested in, because there are just too many people that we could end up talking about. But it's an engaging book and an important one. Congratulations on it. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
The book is called Dangerous Enemy Sympathizers, Canadian Internment Camp B, 1940-45. It is published by Goose Lane Editions. Its author, Andrew Theobald, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.